Well, good evening, everybody. It's interesting, you know, Doug, I appreciate what you're saying about the lesson this morning, but it's interesting how people interpret things differently. I've had some positive feedback from this morning's lesson, and I had some negative feedback from this morning's lesson. And it just reinstalled once again in me the necessity, and I just need to reiterate this, and maybe I need to say this every Sunday for all of us. It doesn't matter what I say. What does the text say? The text this morning is very clear. You cannot claim to know God. You cannot be in Him and continue living in sin. It's hard to deal with, but that's what it says. And I had some feedback this morning, not from people that's been Christians forever or whatever, but they struggled with that. They really struggled with that. Yeah, but I've been a good person. When I was 20 years old, I was a good person, and I know I was saved then, even though I was living in habitual sin. Well, I don't know if you were saved or not, but this is what the text says. You cannot claim to have a relationship with God if you continue living in sin. And I just want us to get this. Don't be angry with me, okay? If you know the text says that, go debate it with God. That's what He says. I'm just the middleman. I just deliver the mail. I'm just the postman, like Angelo was. I just drop it off. You got to deal with that. And I try to distinguish when I speak between what I say and what the Bible says. I try to. This is me, but this is what the Word says. Please, let's always be people that respect the Word. And if it says it, submit to it. That's it. Don't debate it. Just do it. I just had to get that off my chest. Now we can smile. And most of you do. I mean, most of you do respect the Word. Okay, it's been a while since we've been here, and I've had to refresh my brain again as to where we are at. But Paul was on his way to Jerusalem. Just giving a brief recap quickly. He had come back from his third missionary journey. He wants to go to Jerusalem. We think that he's passionate about getting there, and he ultimately wants to go to Rome. But on his way back to Jerusalem, everybody warns him, don't go to Jerusalem. Because you know what's going to happen there to you. Agabus comes and he ties him up and he says, this is the way that you're going to be arrested when you go to Jerusalem. So when he arrives in Jerusalem, he meets up with the church, with the leaders over there. And they tell him, listen, there's some Jews here and there's some Christians. There's some strong Judaic Christians and a strong, obviously Jewish group of people here. And they have heard about you. Legalistic Judaic Christians and a strong Jewish group of people that have heard about you. And they're not going to spare you, okay? And so they make a plan. They say, well, what can we do to soften the blow of the persecution that's going to come? And so they got Paul involved in fulfilling a Nazarite vow. Hopefully this will sort of just show that Paul is not in direct opposition to the law of Moses, but that he actually supports it. He doesn't really have a problem with it. So in that way, he would show compliance with the law of Moses and perhaps soften the feelings of the legalists. So it didn't really work. It didn't really work because the first thing, when these extremely legalistic Jews saw what he was doing, I mean, they immediately started pursuing him. And that was led by the Jews from Asia because they've heard about Paul. They've seen what he had done there. So what they did was, the text tells us that they stirred up a crowd against Paul. Yes, isn't it crazy that you got to raise a whole army for one guy? That we're going to take down this guy. And then what they did is they seized him. I just want to use the words that the text uses. They seized him. They made false accusations against him. They laid hands on him. Okay? They dragged him around, basically like a rag doll. They tried to kill him and they beat him. The text says, all like in a space of like five verses, that's what the text tells us. And I guarantee you, as this was happening, Paul was smiling through it. They shouted the same thing to him as they shouted to Jesus. Who remembers what that was? Get rid of him. So the mob and the riot is so intense that the Roman commander of the city, he has to get involved. And he closes the temple. Nobody's going in. Nobody's going to worship. He closes the temple. That's a big deal in Jerusalem. You don't just close the temple for any and everything. You've got to have a really serious reason why you're doing this. Paul had managed to stir the people up. Well, not really him. The Jews did, right? Paul stood up for Jesus, and the people who stood up against him stood up for the law of Moses. So you have two factions. Paul standing up for Jesus. The Jews, the legalists, are standing up for the law of Moses. And here's the trick. This is the difficult thing. Both of them believe they're serving God. Isn't that the difficulty? Isn't that basically what's happening in Palestine and Israel as well? The Palestinians believe that they are serving Allah. The Jews believe they are serving Yahweh, the land that God, the God that had given them that land. Anyways, Paul counted a joy to suffer for Christ, but the legalists were angry. So now, where we are at now, Paul is being dragged and thrown around, and he's saved just in time by these security guards, by the Roman soldiers, by the commander. They grab him from the crowd because they're about to kill this guy. That's where we are tonight. Are you ready? All right, let's check what happens. As the soldiers were about to take Paul into the barracks, he asked the commander, "May I say something to you? May I say something to you? Do you speak Greek?" The commander replied, "Aren't you the Egyptian who started a revolt and led 4,000 terrorists out into the wilderness some time ago?" Paul answered, "I'm a Jew from Tarsus in Cilicia, a citizen of no ordinary city. Please let me speak to the people." The crowd is going nuts. He's being led up by the stairs into the barracks. Some translation says a castle. I'm sort of imagining in my mind it's stairs that go sort of slowly up. And I'm imagining this mob of people next to the stairs. And as they're going up the stairs, Paul is, maybe he's in chains. I don't know. I didn't pick that up in the text. Maybe they've sort of just bound him. But either way, as he's going up the stairs, he's having a conversation with the commander. What do you do when you're in a situation like that? Paul sees an opportunity where he sees trouble. So the crowd is going crazy, but there's a person next to him that he could talk to, the commander. So he politely draws closer to the commander, and the commander, what do you think the commander thinks about him? He just sees these people going crazy. He probably assumes this is some type of a criminal. This is some type of a bad guy. Right? What would you expect from a bad guy like that? You probably wouldn't expect this type of politeness. Can I say something to you? I think that's what Paul is doing here. I think Paul is deliberately showing politeness because he's got something in mind. That's what Christians do. We always stay polite, even if we're in the middle of a riot. Okay? The commander asks if Paul speaks Greek. Perhaps because many of these soldiers, they couldn't understand Hebrew that well, the Hebrew of the day, the Syriac Chaldean language. And Greek was the common tongue, right? It was the common language. So if he could speak Greek, then maybe the commander says, okay, well, then we can have a conversation. If you want to speak to me, let me just first figure out what language do you speak. Well, Paul answers, yes. And then the commander questions him and says, are you not that Egyptian who started a revolt with 4,000 terrorists in the wilderness? How would you like it if somebody calls you a terrorist? That's essentially what he does. Aren't you the leader of the whole terrorist gang? I looked up this word terrorist, and there's all kinds of interesting things that they say about that word. It's a bad word. The commander is trying to figure out, why are these people so angry at you? Why? What did you do? Now, the scholars tell me that this guy, this commander, his name is Claudius Lysias. I probably wouldn't trust that too much, but that's what they say. That's what his name is. And the man that he's referring to, the man who led these 4,000 people in the wilderness, he was a Jew from Egypt. We don't know what his name is, but Josephus writes about him. But he apparently came to Jerusalem and he gathered a bunch of common people. And he said to them, come, let's go to the Mount of Olives and sit. And you're going to see how the walls of Jerusalem is going to fall down. And I'm going to lead you into the city and we're going to take over the city. That's what Josephus writes about. And so apparently led these people through some parts of the wilderness, whatever the case may be. But Felix, the Roman, took his Roman soldiers and he stopped them and he killed about 400 of them, and 200 of them he took captive. But the leader, that Jewish Egyptian guy, he escaped. So now this, obviously the commander of this army, he knows about this. So he sees Paul and he sees the crowd and he thinks, maybe this is the guy. Maybe I've caught the guy. Yeah, that'll be pretty cool. That'll be, you know. So that's why I asked the question. Well, that word for terrorist could mean assassin, bandit, or a robber. So that's the assumption that the Roman soldier makes, or the commander. Well, Paul answers and he says no. He says actually exactly the opposite. You see, Paul comes from a place. He doesn't come from a terrorist place. He comes from a high-class city. So he says, no, I'm from Tarsus. I'm actually not a terrorist redneck from Egypt. Okay? I'm quite a professional, prestigious individual. I come from a sophisticated place. I come from Tarsus. At one point, the city of Tarsus was a rival to Alexandria in Egypt and also to Athens in Greece. They were measured sort of the same level in terms of academics and philosophy. It was a city remarkable for its culture and zeal towards philosophy and philosophical studies. So Paul is showing this guy, listen, I'm not a terrorist like you assume. I've spoken politely to you. I actually come from Tarsus. I am polite. I am civilized. I am reasonable. I'm not a criminal. You can trust me. I'm an educated man. So then he says, can you let me talk to the people? That was the goal, wouldn't you say? Because the commander can give him permission to talk to the people. And that's all he wanted. He needed to find a way to speak to the people. That was his goal. Now, why do you think Paul wanted to speak to the people? To defend himself? To defend the gospel, maybe? To proclaim himself? Or to save his life, or to save them, to proclaim the gospel to them. Paul, just let this sink in. Paul is standing on the steps on the edge of barracks, and he's got a soldier, maybe a few soldiers with him, and these people hate him. And they shout the same things at him that they shouted at Jesus. Get rid of this guy. They want him dead. And Paul says, I'd like to talk to these guys. He wants to talk to the people that wants to kill him. Now, what would you say? What would you do if you had that opportunity? Well, let me be honest with you. If it's me, these guys are beating me, throwing me around. They hate me. You can smell the hate in the air. I would avoid them, and I would run up the barrack stairs as quickly as possible, get out of that city, never look back again, never go close to those people again. This is generally what people do when their lives are in danger. What do you guys think? Not like, hey, somebody breaks into your house. Hey, let's have a conversation here. Somebody attacks you. Hey, let's talk about this for a moment. No, get away. And maybe Paul is arrogant, like I sometimes am, and sometimes maybe some of you in traffic and that. You don't drive away. You want to face the other driver and have a conversation through the window. So I'm going to speak to these guys. I'm going to speak to the crowd only so I can tell them that they're pieces of trash and fools and retards for rejecting the gospel. Maybe that's a good reason to ask the soldier, can I just tell these guys off quickly? Can I just tell them how pathetic they are since they want to kill me? But you know Paul doesn't do that, right? Well, this is the cool thing, because tonight's text is just one of those opportunities once again where the greatest apostle ever stands, and this is just a holy picture for me. He stands on stairs. You want to talk about pulpit preaching, this is it. He stands on the stairs and he speaks to a crowd of people that want him dead. What does he say to them? It's beautiful. He says to them, let's see when this thing works. after receiving the commander's permission, Paul stood on the steps and motioned to the crowd. When they were all silent, he said to them in Aramaic, which is really Hebrew, the Hebrew of the day, "Brothers and fathers, listen now to my defense." When they heard him speak to them in Aramaic, they became very quiet. Can you picture this? It's crazy what's happening. He motions with his hand. He speaks in their language. And suddenly they're all quiet. Do you think the Spirit of God is involved here? It's only the Spirit of God that can do this type of stuff. Listen, the Spirit of God will quiet people down so you can speak to them. Let him, until God will give you the opportunity, then you can speak. It's beautiful. What a beautiful picture. It's the epitome of preaching. Having the opportunity to preach to people outside the church. On stairs by the side of army barracks. To people who don't believe in your Jesus. With perhaps chains on his hands, he motions with it. And he selects a language to speak to those onlookers. And they're all quiet. God is giving them a chance to listen to the gospel. So he speaks to them in Hebrew, the language of the people. Just by speaking in their language, he's telling them, "I'm actually one of you. We are actually family." It's amazing how language can affect things. Now, I know you have no idea, probably. Who here speaks any other language except American? Yeah, so this is difficult for you. Okay, there's sign language over here, and I guarantee you that works as well. It's incredible what it does. My grandfather was a preacher. I think I've shared with you before, but when he was a small boy, he grew up on a farm in Zululand, and he in the area where he lived was the royal family lived there. The Zulu king and his family lived there, and so he learned Zulu from them, which is the royal dialect. And when he went to the first grade and he went to his class, he couldn't speak Afrikaans properly. He spoke Zulu. He's a white guy speaking Zulu to all the white kids. And the white kids are like confused. Hey, we've never seen a white guy speak a black African language. In any case, and so they sent him back because he couldn't speak the white language. And so he had to go. But from young, he learned this language. And when he eventually one day went to Bible college and became a preacher, his ministry was towards black people. And he was extremely successful simply because he spoke their language. And I've seen it so many times. He would walk into a place, suddenly they would hear him speak their language. They would immediately listen to what he says. Language, and I can testify, myself and Alfreda, when I hear somebody speak Afrikaans, immediately, woo, something switches on. Because you immediately feel closer to that person. That's what language does. There's a familiarity with it, and a familiarity. It's like we are family. We're from the same place, man. It's attached to culture and to your being. Like if you were to go live in a foreign country and then you hear an American speak, you would have that same feeling, that roar, you know, the American roar. So they hear him speak Hebrew, and they kept even more silent because they want to hear what this guy's got to say. So then Paul said, where am I now? Oh yeah, I just want to look at those. So brothers and fathers, listen now to my defense. Okay? It's interesting the word he uses there is apologia, where we get the word apologetics from. And he's basically saying, here's my answer to your attack on me. So he's defending himself, but at the same time, the gospel. Because they go hand in hand. He's defending the messenger and the message. So he calls them, first of all, he speaks in their language, and then he calls them what? Brothers, fathers, men. We're of the same family. Many of these people were operating on hearsay. They were there because there was a crowd and a riot, and they didn't even know what exactly was the issue was. And so Paul wants to clarify that. None of them have had a reasonable conversation with Paul before, so Paul says, let's be reasonable about this. Let me explain to you what's going on. And then Paul starts to give his testimony. And he says, let me tell you what happened. Let me tell you how I ended up here. Why are you hating me? Let me tell you where I come from and why I am who I am and what I am. This is fundamental, because if you're sitting here tonight, this is one of the things, honestly, I've got to work on, and I guarantee you many of you got to work on. It's like, have you ever sat and just thought for a moment, why are you here in your spiritual life? If you had to put it down, what's your testimony? How did you end up with the faith that you have? And have you ever documented it? And if you could document it, what would it look like? I think that's an incredible exercise. What did God do in your life so that you are submitting your life to Him? That's what Paul's going to do. So Paul said, now he starts preaching. I am a Jew born in Tarsus of Cilicia, but brought up in this city. I studied under Gamaliel and was thoroughly trained in the law of our ancestors. This is a key verse, I was just as zealous for God as any of you are today. I persecuted the followers of this way to their death, arresting both men and women and throwing them into prison. As the high priest and all the council can themselves testify, I even obtained letters from them to their associates in Damascus and went there to bring these people as prisoners to Jerusalem to be punished. He says, I was zealous in a perfect manner after the law of the fathers. That's literally a good translation of it. He's saying to them, I used to be where you are right now. But let me tell you what happened. And he says, let's look at my pedigree. I'm a Jew. You guys are Jews. I'm a Jew. Okay, we are brothers, man. So I'm a Jew, and I was raised in the city. You guys were probably raised here as well. So we connected. Yeah, he connects with them on every level. It's language. It's geographical location. It's the genetic material of being a Jew. And then he says, I was mentored by Gamaliel. Oh, they respect Gamaliel. They know who he was. Paul wouldn't use that name if he didn't think that they knew who he was. So he says, I have the pedigree. So what I say is credible. I'm not a fool. I don't come from the wilderness. I'm educated. I know what I'm talking about. I was taught properly, and I was zealous. I was a zealot. The law of the fathers, I think, here is very significant, because Paul looked like he was abandoning what the fathers had believed in. What our fathers believe are very important to us. It trickles down. We trust our fathers, don't we? When it comes to Judaism, it's even much more deeper than that, because they've had thousands of years of believing and trusting and following the fathers. And so these Jews, when they look at Paul, they say, here's a man that's rejecting the fathers. I think that's significant. So he says to them, I am where you are, I was where you are now, and I did what you do now. Because I also went to go kill Christians and persecute them. I persecuted people like me. I persecuted Christians to the point of chains and probably even death. I sent both men and women to prison. When you read this, you wonder, I don't know if you wonder, but if Paul grew up in Jerusalem and he was there, why do these people not know him? Well, we need to remember that this is about 20 years later after what he's talking about here, after the great persecution of Christians in Jerusalem. Perhaps many of these men were younger. I think they were very zealous. And Paul had been away from Jerusalem for many years, out of sight, out of mind. Remember, Paul had been all over the world. He wasn't in Jerusalem. But Paul nevertheless is a reliable source, because he doesn't say, this is just my testimony. What does he do? He gives names. Gamaliel. And what does he talk about? He talks about the high priest. And he talks about the council. I mean, if you guys don't trust what I say, you can go find out. Now, many of the council members probably changed, but I guarantee you that this was documented. That's why he says there that there were letters. I've obtained letters from them to their associates. And I guarantee you that these letters were probably available. And so you can go test my testimony, I think is what Paul is saying. is saying. He had a legit testimony. All right, let's see what happens further. Now he explains the story. So he's on his way to Damascus, right? About noon, as I came near Damascus, suddenly a bright light from heaven flashed around me. I fell to the ground and heard a voice say to me, "Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? Who are you, Lord?" I asked. "I'm Jesus of Nazareth, whom you are persecuting," he replied. My companions saw the light, but they did not understand the voice of him who was speaking to me. When I read this, these are the words that came to my mind. While I was on my way, a light attacked me. Have you ever been attacked by a light that you fall on your knees? This is literally what Paul experiences here. And what's interesting for me, it happens at noon. What is noon in America? Is it 12? 12 a.m. p.m. Okay. Yeah. So, I don't know. In other places around the world, generally it works like this. The sun sort of comes up at 6 and goes down at about 6. So 12 is sort of the middle of the day. I've realized, look, everything's upside down, you know, on the northern hemisphere. I must be on. I mean, yeah, it feels like it's at its hottest like 2 or 3 in the afternoon here. Okay, but in most places, and probably in Israel, 12 is about, you know, the sun is right above you. So at the hottest, sunniest moment of the day, a light appears. And Revelation 1 verse 16 tells us that Jesus shines brighter than the sun. If a light is so bright that you fall to the ground, then goodness, that is a very serious type of light. This light is so powerful that it throws Paul down to his knees. That is the only response that you get when you meet the light that spoke the world into existence. There's only one thing. You go down on your knees. I don't care how arrogant you are. That's the only place you go. And when you are on your knees, then God can speak to you. It's strange. We don't listen to God unless we are on our knees. I'm like that. And you know what I mean by that? Because all the old people are saying, "Yeah, but what about my knee replacement?" You know what I'm saying, right? Talking about humility, okay? Humbly going before your God. When we approach God with humility, we can listen to Him. If we approach God with arrogance, we're not going to hear anything. So we go to Him with humility. Paul has a conversation with Jesus on his knees. Because he asks Jesus, "Who are you?" And Jesus says, "You are persecuting me." When you persecute God's people, you persecute Jesus. The guys with Paul, it seems like they saw the light, but they didn't understand the voice. It's like they didn't hear what he was saying. They were afraid because the light was enough to scare them. But this was a personal conversation between Paul and Jesus. So they hear the sound, they see the light, but the experience is not with them. They're on the outside. Paul is alone with Jesus. And it made me think, we cannot listen to Jesus for other people. Unless people go themselves, because I get that a lot. You know, people come to me because they want me to give them special access to Jesus. And I'm like, I'm not the mediator. Jesus is available directly to you. The incense is within the holy place in the heavenly temple. The prayers, your prayers go directly into the presence of God. Yours does, all of us does. When you come to God with a contrite heart, you don't have to pray through a priest or the guy that stands here. You can go directly to God. So people have to go down on their knees alone with Jesus if they want to hear Him. And what I love about Paul here, which this so beautifully illustrates, is the two most important questions a person needs to deal with in this life. The first question is over there in bold. Who are you, Lord? That's The first question. We have to figure out who our God is. If you believe that a God created you, who is He? What is He like? What is His character like? And there's great confusion in the world. Some people believe He's like Santa Claus, and other people believe He's like Trump. Other people believe He's like a policeman, and the other guy says, no, He's like the Easter Bunny. Who is God? Who is Jesus? That's an incredibly important question. And the second question Paul then asks after that, after the who are you, Lord, is, what shall I do, Lord? What shall I do? That is a key question. We're going to get back to that. And after he asks Jesus, what shall I do? Jesus says, get up. Get up and go to Damascus. There you will be told all that you have been assigned to do. I've got an assignment for you. My companions led me by the hand into Damascus because the brilliance of the light had blinded me. So, this is a key question. What shall I do, Lord? And I think it's important to talk about this because it comes down to action, behavior. If you believe, then do. This is so important. I'll elaborate on that. I believe. It's like Paul is saying, okay, I believe you are Jesus. Oh my goodness, you're real. Oh, I've been making a mistake here. I've been persecuting your people. I believe you are Jesus. I'm blind. I'm on my knees. I submit. Yes, what must I do now? The faith is always proven by action. They go together. It's like breathing. You can't separate. There's inhale and exhale. There's faith and action. Faith and action. And what we see in theological circles is they try to separate the two. No, it's just faith. Oh, no, it's just behavior. No, it's just faith. No, it's just behavior. No, they always go together. Show me one text where it doesn't go together. It always goes together. This is so important. And here is perhaps one example. I never thought I would say this, but I'm going to say it. Where we could say this is one of the greatest benefits of the Jewish faith and religions like Judaism and Islam. You know what's the great benefit about those faiths? They remind us that we've got to do something. Because in the Jewish mind, it's standing up and going to make a sacrifice. It's waking up in the morning and not working on a Sabbath. It is physically going to the temple to pray. The whole religion is built around do, 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 do. And the criticism is this. But what's happening inside of you, right? That's the criticism. It's because you've got to have both. Jesus never had a problem with doing. He had a problem with doing without the inner, right? So they go hand in hand. And so it's understandable why Paul, the first thing that Paul says is, what must I do? Because he's a born, purebred Jew. He's used to doing for God. And it's natural, because the moment you realize who God is, the next question should be, what must I do, Lord? What do you expect of me? They go hand in hand. So this elevates the danger of this faith-only mentality. And it's the first time it really struck me. The text, the Ephesians 2:8 text, is, you know, you've got to deal with that very carefully. We've been saved by grace through faith. And I had this morning in a conversation with somebody after my lesson, you know, but where's the grace? The theme of this morning's lesson was this, for in case anybody didn't understand it, because I realized afterwards when I talk to people, I'm like, you listen maybe to 5 minutes, but not the whole thing. Okay, you didn't get the whole thing. This is the thing. God forgives our sins. That's where His grace comes in, right? But there's a difference between God forgiving your sins that we do occasionally, accidentally, sometimes deliberately, but temporarily. There's a difference between those sins, because those we're always going to have, and habitual sin, where your whole lifestyle is drunkenness, and your whole lifestyle is fornication, and your whole lifestyle is adultery. That's sin. I don't believe God forgives that, because you're not saved. You're living a lifestyle as if God does not exist, as if you've not been born again. You're living like a person in the world, and you can't call yourself a Christian, okay? It's important to distinguish that. And so that was the message of this morning's lesson. And the person says to me, yeah, but where's the grace? We just have to believe. It's not about the actions. It's not about the deeds. What do you think about that? You see, this is the danger of when you keep on saying grace, faith, and what you do doesn't matter. It goes hand in hand. Our works got to go with our faith. Anyways, there once again you have this preacher that has to elaborate further than he has to. All right, let's go on. Oh, before we go there. So he says, get up, go. Tasso, I've got an assignment for you. And then Paul says, the original language, actually, it says, because the brilliance of the light had blinded me. The original language says, the glory of the light blinded me. The arrogant, self-sufficient man needs to be led by the hand. Do you get it? Yo, the leader becomes the follower. Jesus had to humble Paul radically because in 1 Timothy 1 verse 13, Paul describes himself as a blasphemer, a persecutor, and a violent man. And Jesus says, I know what to do with a violent man. I'll get you down your knees very quickly. I'll just take away your sight. Jesus had to humble him before he could use him. And being struck with blindness is a very big deal. Who knows of incidents in the Bible where people got struck with blindness, where God made people blind? There's four instances. Sodom and Gomorrah. Who did God make blind? God blinded people who were trying to rape other men. What does that tell you about who God makes blind? The other one, I think it's Elisha and the Assyrians, where God blinds the whole Assyrian army so the Israelites could destroy them. Once again, pagans are being blinded. And the third instance is this one. Now, can you imagine Paul, who knows the Bible, who knows the history, who understands God, suddenly he's made blind by Jesus. What do you think he's thinking? Yo, this is ultimate judgment. What I'm experiencing right now is only, it's the only thing that happens to people who are enemies of God. They get blinded. And then later on in his own life, we've dealt with the text. Paul speaks to Elimas, and he says, from now on, you're going to be blind. Because he serves the devil. Those are the four instances where people get blind. So Paul, the self-righteous Pharisee, is humbled by an almighty God and treated like a pagan. This was hard for Paul. So Paul says, the text says, a man named Ananias came to see me. He was a devout observer of the law and highly respected by all the Jews living there. He stood beside me and said, Brother Saul, receive your sight. And that very moment I was able to see him. There are two things that Paul says here about Ananias. First, he mentions his name. In other words, he's saying, I'm not making up stories. This is a real guy. Okay? You can go look for Ananias in Damascus and you'll know that what I say is true. But Paul says two things about him. Number one, he's a devout Mosaic Jew. And number two, he's got a good reputation amidst the Jewish community. I find it incredible that the people Paul is supposed to bind release him. Paul went to Damascus to go catch this guy because he's a disciple of Jesus. And now he gets into the house of the guy, one of the guys he's supposed to capture with letters from the Sanhedrin, and this guy sets him free. It's incredible. He went to arrest Ananias but ended up being set free by him. He gives him sight, but he also gives him a message. He gives him a miracle followed by a message. He gives him sight again, and then he gives him a message. You came here because you believed you had the truth and I had the lie. And now you know that I have the truth and you carried the lie. So this is the message. Then he said, the God of our ancestors has chosen you to know his will and to see the righteous one and to hear words from his mouth. You will be his witness to all people of what you have seen and heard. And now what are you waiting for? Get up, be baptized, and wash your sins away, calling on his name. The message is this. Yahweh, the God of the Jews, has chosen you for three things. To know his will, to see his son, the righteous one, and to hear the voice of his mouth. God had planned this. This is no man-made story. This is real. And when I read this, and I look at what people say about Paul. People say about Paul, like, I'm not going to just believe what Paul says. I don't know if he was a legit apostle. and you read this, then you wonder, oh my goodness, you're a fool if you ignore what Paul says, because God chose him to hear God's voice. And then he says, I'll give you a mission. You need to go and be my witness to all people. And what's the Greek word there? Martyr. You're going to be a martyr for me. You came to kill. You came to Damascus to kill, but you will go into the world and you will die. So get baptized, get rid of your sin, put your faith into action. When I returned to Jerusalem and was praying at the temple, I fell into a trance and saw the Lord speaking to me. Quick, he said, leave Jerusalem immediately because the people here will not accept your testimony about me. Lord, I replied, these people know that I went from one synagogue to another to imprison and beat those who believe in you. And when the blood of your martyr Stephen was shed, I stood there giving my approval and guarding the clothes of those who were killing him. So Paul leaves for Jerusalem, and then him and Jesus have this dialogue while he's praying at the temple. From within the walls of the temple, God warns him. From the place where God dwells, he's told by God to leave Jerusalem because the people won't accept the martyria, the message of the martyr. They won't listen to you. And what does Paul do? He responds to God by telling God, I think you're overreacting a little bit. I know these guys. They know me. They know what I've done. I think you've got this wrong. He's going into a debate with Jesus. And what does God say to him? He doesn't debate with him. He says, go, I will send you far away to the Gentiles. God is a great leader, isn't he? Paul underestimated the offense of the gospel. I think if Paul stayed in Jerusalem longer, he would have been a dead man. But God's like, no. I'm going to send you for quite a number of years. You're going to preach the gospel and the whole world's going to be converted because of you. So I don't need you here. Go there. Okay, I'm done. You know you can't trust those words. Okay. I want to give you some personal thoughts. Sorry, tonight I'm going on longer. It's not my fault. It's all the verses in the Bible. Just personal thoughts from me that I think is worthy to share with you. So you can pray for me. And whoever is on the same mission, my wife as well. It's been a tough week. And when I dealt with this text today, it was really uplifting for me. Because, and this is just personally me, I'm sharing with you as somebody who stands here every week. Paul gives me courage and patience and calmness to continue speaking to people who oppose the gospel. You know, if Paul can stand up and say, okay, I'm going to talk to these people who verbally hate me, I'm going to make time for them, and surely I can do the same with people who I invest energy in that just don't care. Paul shows me that the gospel is offensive, even to people who claim to fear God. That's a difficult task that we have at hand. We have a message that people don't like. Paul inspires me because he was persecuted in his body, and the worst thing that happens to us is just rejection. But he still kept going. I want to give up. He kept going, and so must I. But I have a great hope after studying this text. God comes to Paul while he is praying, and he says to him, get up and go because these people are not going to listen to you. This week, a few times, I had those thoughts in my mind, I want to get up and go. I just want to leave. Because it feels like nobody listens. It feels like we're in a big land. Like God has given us this land and we're plowing the field. We're plowing the land and we're putting water and we're putting compost. We're all making all of these investments into people and we are spending time with them and we're trying to sow seed. And we put seed in and we give water the whole time and nothing grows. That's what it feels like. And so you wonder, We're wasting our time. Why is nothing growing? And then it dawned on me. God will take me out of Sweet Home if there are no more people who will listen. Because that's why he took Paul out. So wherever we find ourselves, whether you are in your job, your workplace, wherever you find yourself and it feels like nobody's listening, you are their place, but God will take you out if nobody will listen. That's what he did with Paul. That gives me encouragement. So therefore, I know tonight that there are people in this town that need to hear and will hear, and God is at work. Two things that maybe can add value to your life, two thoughts, because I had to give you something as well. I can't just eat everything myself. The spiritual radio channel is clearest on your knees. It is there where you not only speak to God, but where God speaks to you. Secondly, telling your story is the simplest way to witness. You don't need elaborate theology or philosophy or be a biblical machine to tell someone what God has done in your life. Some of you have spoken to me, how do I tell people about Jesus? Well, just tell them about your life. That's what Paul did. It's authentic. It's really authentic.